Hello and welcome to episode 161 of the Film Yak podcast. I'm John.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm JR.
This week we're talking my pick. It's that time, finally, for Severed Ways, the Norse discovery of America, directed by Tony Stone, starring Tony Stone, and from 2007. We're also going to be talking other stuff we watched. It's the same exact routine that we've been doing for 30 episodes now. We used to talk about the deep dive at the end, but anyway, how's it going? This is the biggest problem of our show routine is that we blow our load before we start recording every time. Already know about Kevin's car trouble and my car trouble. And JR's baby situation. It's just nonstop. We can't even re-talk about everything, right?
No.
Yeah.
Is there any movie news we need to get out of the way? Did you guys see the video of Quentin Tarantino being accosted by pro-Palestine protesters?
No.
What did he do?
He apparently visited Israel, and people, you know, the anti-Zionists aren't happy about that. And it's like a video of this woman who I guess is like some type of internet personality. I'm not aware of her. But she starts screaming at him at a restaurant, and then she tells him to say the N-word over and over again. She's like, say the N-word, because he writes the N-word in all of his scripts.
Yeah.
And then they keep chanting toes at him. Toes, toes, toes. And they put their feet in his face and stuff. It's pretty great, actually. I enjoyed it. But anyway, he doesn't seem too bothered by it, to be honest.
But I mean, I like the direction they went. they got specific.
Yeah.
They've seen his work. I like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's funny. It's like, because he's like a, it's like becoming part of the old guard, you know, like as opposed to like when he came up, he was such like a new and exciting hip filmmaker. And now he's like one of these old curmudgeon-y, like Seinfeld, you know.
And that's why his next movie is his last one.
Right.
He doesn't want to be that old guard.
Or like Richard Dreyfuss. Did you guys hear about Richard Dreyfuss and what he did?
No, but he's generally cranky and mad about woke culture, right?
Yeah, he's like, hey, it's like he was at some like the screening of Jaws or something, and they were gonna like do a Q&A, and he came on stage in a dress and like demanded that he be like she, her pronouns or something. Like he was making fun of trans people. It was just really embarrassing. Like, he's the worst. Him and James Woods, they're the worst. But and John Voight. Although he is in, John Voight's in Megalopolis, so I gotta reassess, but
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He is. Apparently, I should tell you guys this. My brother is friends. I've mentioned this before on the podcast. My brother is like his best friend in the world is the actor who played Angus in the movie Angus.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. He came to our Thanksgiving one time at my mom's house. Really, Thanksgiving. He's a nice guy. His name's Charlie something. And I think it's Talbot or Talbert or something. Anyways.
Yeah.
He is in Megalopolis as John Voight's assistant, apparently. So, yeah, he apparently was over there the other day at my mom's house telling them all about it. And it made me really angry because nobody told me he was coming, and nobody told me he was in Megalopolis, and that he talked to Francis Ford Coppola and was directed by him. You know, I would have liked to have been there, but whatever.
Man,
next time I guess.
Could have had him guest on the podcast.
All right, well, let's get into our movie here, right?
Yes.
You guys ready to start talking about the movie?
Let's talk about the movie.
Okay. This week we're talking Severed Ways, the Norse discovery of America, or just Severed Ways as it is referred to in many publications. I'm not sure about the title of this movie. Like, I feel like sometimes it's referred to just as Severed Ways. The Norse discovery of America sort of add-on comes up at the very end of the film, but it's not at the beginning, I don't think.
But there are no credits at the beginning.
There's no title card at the beginning?
I didn't think so. There's a. I thought the first words we got with the chapter, first chapter.
Yeah, I think maybe. So.
That's fair. Anyways, this movie's from 2000 and...
Oh, no, okay, it's not the chapter. Is... The first words we get are the fucking Star Wars scroll.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
This is a confusing... Okay, I'm confused already. Sorry. This is... Okay, so IMDb lists this movie as 2007. Wikipedia says 2007. Letterboxd says 2009.
So,
I understand this.
Yeah. I don't know why Letterboxd has the 2009 there, but I know that this was released theatrically in March of 2009 after premiering at festivals in 2007.
That must be why then.
The 2007 is like technically correct, but like almost all the reviews that you read of this or could read of this are definitely going to be from 2009.
Okay. So this is from 2009. It stars Tony Stone. It's directed by Tony Stone. And it also stars several other actors who don't act, like Fior Tedesco and David Perry. David Perry might act. No, he doesn't. And
Gabby Hoffman
is in the movie for 4 seconds. So she's an actor you might recognize. But other than that, this is a movie about two Vikings who are left behind after the rest of their party is attacked by Native Americans or First Nations people, I guess, because it's in Canada, right? And they come back. They realize they've been left behind. They're lost, and they decide to move northward back to this person they keep calling Leif, who we can infer is Leif Erikson, I suppose. I don't even know what the history of this is. This is like the Vinland sagas and all this. Yeah, they invoke the Vinland sagas in the opening scroll, that Star Wars scroll, that scroll that JR was referring to there. And what follows is an almost partial documentary-esque digital standard def video look at two men surviving in the woods, killing animals to eat them, taking massive dumps, killing Christian monks that they come across, because, you know.
They really had to go out of their way to, like, make that make sense. But, yeah.
In what way?
So he's credited as Irish monk.
Yeah.
And I was like...
A couple Irish monks.
How would the Irish be there at the same time as the Vikings? The Irish, like... The Vikings like occupied Ireland for hundreds of years at this time. Like it's
well, he said like, he was a slave in Ireland.
Yeah,
in Iceland, like they had to
like right, so they had to like do all this explanation stuff. And it's like for some reason on that I call that part of like the conversion to Christian training montage, and it's like that's the only dialogue we actually hear is the expository dialogue of why this Irish monk is there. As he's, converting the other Viking.
Now, and is that an issue for you?
Conversion?
No, the monk's presence in the film.
Oh, I mean, it was like how is this happening? How are there two monks there? Like how are there two monks during the Norse discovery? So I guess I am glad that they made it make sense.
It's interesting because it's like I talk to I have a friend at school who's a history teacher, and we get into like discussions about film all the time because he's a history teacher, he's very like I don't know like hyper aware of anachronisms and things like this in movies and in Braveheart that's not the way that happened and they would never wear kilts at this time and that sort of thing. And he still acknowledges that something like Braveheart is a great film and he enjoys it, but he's like, he just, that kind of stuff bothers him.
Yeah.
And this is like that same sort of thing where, honestly, it wasn't even until this viewing that I even considered that, of course there wouldn't be two Irish monks making a monastery out of wood in the woods, you know, in Newfoundland. But I think I've never really cared about it because the underlying point of it seems to be that they are opposed. It's like they're commenting on the the use of metal and everything. The songs that they're using relates to that too, right? They're commenting on like the sort of like the of the Kearns thing where he burned down all the churches because he claimed that it was like an infringement on, you know, Old Norse mythology and religion and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's another reason why it annoyed me. There are a few things, like I don't know why Tony Stone felt the need to use the music of like one of the worst people in the world for metal, like Varg Vikernes, Burzum. He is an awful Nazi. Like,
yeah, I agree.
He's using like the synth music that he made like in prison. I don't get it. Like, plenty of the people involved in the early 1990s like Scandinavian black metal thing were burning churches or like wanted to burn churches. I don't know why you had to use that guy, but connected to that guy is like, I feel like Tony Stone was interested in recreating some imagery from metal, and like the idea of like that, or just the image of that like cross burning, I think was a very important thing for him to get in this movie. Regardless of whether it fit with his narrative, because I think you could have had the other Viking. It was Volnord. Is that right? Volnard.
Whatever. Volnard,
yeah. Sure. That dude. You could have had him like go into some sort of like spiritual journey without the monk. Might have even been better without the monk, but
how would that have happened though?
I don't know. I mean, he's already like looking askance at what's Tony Stone's name? It's like
Warren?
Yeah. In my notes I wrote Tony Stone as Strawberry Blonde and Volnard as the brunette. I didn't write down their names.
Volnard is redhead.
Okay.
Just saying. Not a brunette.
So. Yeah. Okay. Camera, you can't tell.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair. Kevin, what do you think about the inclusion of the Christian imagery and the monk and so forth?
I'm not familiar with all of the backstory that JR is. I for sure understood why, you know, why they would use metal and synth, you know, because like I think it's harkening back to 80s sword and sorcery dark fantasy films. These days, especially like, you know, if you think like when you think about Vikings, you probably think about, you know, the TV show. You think about that guy who played the Mountain in Game of Thrones, and you probably think about death metal, Amon Amarth or whoever, you know, pick your poison. I don't know, like, so I've the use of it for me was fine. Like, you know, like I like the fact that whatever his name was uses like Golden Years and Queen in A Knight's Tale. I like that stuff.
Brian Helgeland.
Yeah. Like watching this movie, I kept, you know, it's like, okay, so like this is like it's like an extended like, you know, Viking metal music video, because you know the music is playing and you know stuff is happening on screen. There's not really much of a story, and then there are parts where it's like, oh, you know, a couple of LARPers together in the woods and decided to film it. So.
Yeah.
It's funny too that I was looking like on the production thing on Wikipedia, you know, it says it's like filmed with, you know, HD pro cameras, and it's like I started to think like if this at that if in 2000, you know, 5, 6, 7, if this is what counted as HD, high definition, like, what was, like, I would love to go back and look at some of, you know, like, I don't know, like VHS or, you know, whatever else, you know, that they were filming on, you know, the film stock or whatever. And like get yeah. to how they just how they could legitimately say, you know, this to, is high definition.
To Tony Stone's credit here, or in his cinematographers, I believe there were two credited. I think there were two credited directors of photography for this.
Oh,
maybe I'm wrong. Someone can pull that up while I'm talking. While I'm just blowing air here, but the again to their credit. I think that, you know, he's like, he's doing a 100% natural lighting situation, it seems. And he's doing a handheld that is at times like he's moving so much. It is inducing nausea, especially at the beginning. Like, I think it is difficult for, you know, the camera, the pixels to keep up with all that motion with the light. And I think these cameras under different circumstances probably could produce something that looks higher quality. And then also, like, when he slows down and when he's filming just like scenery, I don't think it looks awful. I think it looks appropriate, I guess, for what he's doing and with the equipment he has.
I'd agree with that. Like, especially like during like some of the flashbacks, like when Volnard's, you know, thinking about his sister, you know, by the sea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, of course, a Christianity conversion story, which is something that makes him susceptible to that, you know, in the present.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think that's okay. About the cinematography, I'm in the camp where I like, this is not high def, okay? I don't know, that's that quote from the Wikipedia page that says this is high def, they're not using high def cameras. Like, I don't believe that.
I assume they're like, using like
that was
mini,
like the model of the camera.
Yeah, they're using, right, well, it says HD Pro Digital Video, but I mean, that's not.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what that is. It says mini DV on the thing. Anyways, but yeah, so it's like, I assume they're using mini DV or they're using like a, I mean, they're using like a, it looks just like 28 Days Later to me. Like the whole, the grit or the graininess of it looks just like 28 Days Later, which they shot on like the XL1. So that makes total sense. They'd be using like an XL1 to shoot this or an XL2. And it look, for me, I think it looks great. I like that. I like the look of it for the most part. I think there are scenes where, Stone doesn't hide things like he should. Like, he's got this camera that it doesn't have great resolution, and you think he would use that to his advantage, but instead he like for instance, like their costumes and things, like their costumes don't always look great, and I think he could have done a lot to shoot around that and hide that more with the, you know, with the lighting and things, maybe like shoot when there's less light, things like that. But I do love like the, like the scene you were talking about with him and his sister, or the guy and his sister by the seaside. I think all that looks great. Obviously, the scenery is doing a lot of heavy lifting there. But I remember that shot of him running towards the guy to kill him. That's in the trailer. And I remember that shot being like striking to me in the trailer back in 07 or 09, whenever I saw the trailer. And the shaky cam stuff, which mainly happens at the beginning in those first like couple of minutes. Yeah. Is the confusion of being lost, right? I mean, it's just like,
yeah,
they don't know where they are. They thought that, and they're coming back from, they don't know where they're at a strange place. They're coming back, they're finding all their friends dead. Nobody's there anymore. Oh my God. Yeah, of course, it's like confusion. The camera's flying around. I don't have a problem with that at all.
The way he goes just like back and forth over like the stones on the beach, though, that drove me a little crazy. And again, I got you. Like, what he was doing there wasn't very long, and he calmed down. And then when he did stuff like that again, it was, like, for point of view reasons. Like, right when we have the Skraelings kind of watching them, and then we get with the shaky stuff. There's like a POV reason for that. Was still there, like looking through a looking glass.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like that. I like the looking glass stuff. I don't
like
even
because I.
It's
I got
really
it.
it's a good idea. Yeah. But again, yeah, I think that there are things where, in the hands of a more, not even a better filmmaker, like if Tony Stone had made this as like his third feature or something, and he had a little money to make it, I think we'd see something totally more mature and interesting than we see here. But that doesn't take away from, like, I really just appreciate the movie from the, like, the scope that he's attempting to achieve with very, very, very little, and his ways of circumventing those problems, like the way that he uses, I'm sure you guys read that he uses Bergman's dialogue as the dialogue, and that it doesn't match. But I think that works in a way sort of similar to what Kevin was saying. Like, it invokes like an older film quality, or like the 80s sword and sorcery thing you were saying. It mm-hmm. almost invokes that, because it's like every time they talk, you hear like this like 50s mono recording of Swedish voices. Yeah. I thought that was really interesting. I would have liked if they had like actually learned the dialogue and mouthed it correctly, because they're just sort of, I don't know what they're saying. I'm assuming they're not, they're not saying it in English, but
they were not saying anything.
Okay. Really? Yeah.
I just thought they were kind of fake talking.
Yeah.
And almost and then, like silent acting. Yeah.
The, also just from the Wikipedia page, so we can get rid of all of these pieces of trivia. when he uses the scene from Quest for Fire in the
where
he throws the burning torch at the wolves, I thought that it matched incredibly well. I don't know why. To me, it did. Anyways, I'm watching it on my laptop. I don't know how you guys felt, but I thought it looked really good when he did that.
Yeah, I mean, it was. Yeah, this was an interesting, like, this was an interesting thing to see, because, like, I certainly did not expect to actually, you know, see a person defecating on screen and them actually killing two roosters. So, yeah, that was a little.
Is that a problem? Are we okay with that?
I don't know. I mean, I would say that in this particular context, I would say that it's not a problem. Now, personally, I have zero plans to watch Cannibal Holocaust, where it seems more for like, I don't know. Like, I've heard like Joe Bob Briggs talks about how Italians don't have the same like sentimentality towards animals that we have in America. And apparently, you know, like when they were killing the animals in Cannibal Holocaust, like the actual like natives that they were filming were like, hey, you know, who gets to eat the baboon, or who gets to eat, you know, this animal or that animal. But I don't know. It just feels it in that context, where it's like a horror film going out of its way to, like, you know, shock and be grotesque. I feel like they don't get a pass.
You might also say like chickens are like, we as Westerners value chicken lives a lot less than we value like a grown tortoise, which is something that they kill in Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah.
Or a monkey or whatever, you know, like those are exotic, so we value their lives more.
I don't know how I feel. I almost give it a pass because this is fitting into the part of the movie where he's trying to show us like the survival stuff. And the survival stuff I think is good. Like, I really liked watching them cut down trees and build a shelter. I didn't like them pooping, but like, I understand how he thought that would fit. And then he doesn't just like kill the rooster, he also, we see him like deal with it and cook it.
Yeah, he pulls the feathers and he guts it and everything. He pulls, he reaches into its body cavity and pulls out the yellow stuff.
So it doesn't seem, I mean, I would be, honestly, I'd be surprised if he didn't, or if like they didn't legitimately eat that chicken. It seems like they might have. Sure. Of course, that could be like some trickery where they were like, you know, actually like shooting something took too long and now this chicken is rotten, so we got to get something new. I don't know. But
could be a lot of things, sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't seem as just like cruel as it could have.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, he is literally being cruel in the moment. He has just burned down this settlement and he's like, well, now I got to eat. Fuck these guys, chickens. They're mine.
Yeah.
I think what I was going to say earlier too, I forgot to say that, I think my biggest, the parts of the film that I like the most are like what you were just talking about, like the procedural stuff, like where they're making the shelter or they're cooking the fish or gutting the chicken. These kinds of things are really great to me. And then the stuff that I like the least is like plot stuff, like him, yeah. Like meeting the priest and deciding that he's going to let him live, and him abandoning Tony Stone's character, and then like Tony Stone's interactions with the Indians and the drugging and the rape and all that stuff. I was like, all that stuff is sort of like, I love the idea of them interacting with Indians, like cool, but and I think I'm giving Tony Stone credit for, I think that what he's getting at with the Indian raping him is like a reversal of like the whole, like Vikings are pillagers, right? Like they rape, they kill, right? And it's like now he's being raped. But it's also like weird because he's a man and it's like he's forced to have sex with a beautiful woman. I don't know. You know,
it's like, there's like a lack of violence that would be associated with the action if it were reversed.
Right.
And also she just like leaves him alone after that.
Yeah. I would think that's what he's getting at, but I think it's clumsy and it doesn't make sense if you read it any other way, because like, I don't know what she's doing. Like she's just horny and she wanted to fuck. Like, I don't know. I don't know.
She's like, I'm going to give him this mound of sloppy blackberries and
right.
see if I can get this.
Yeah. And then I'm going to tie him up and have my way with him.
Well, you know, it's so weird. Like her, not partner, just like the other Skraeling, the male, you know, he's all like angry and he wants to go kill. He's like, I'll go get the other one to kill him, but I'll just leave this one here with you. You do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Not angry about this one for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why they're angry to begin with either. That's the other thing. It's like, I mean, except for that, they would acknowledge that these two guys are part of the same group that we're assuming these Indians are the same Indians that killed their friends earlier, but they've been moving north for the entire film. So I would assume they're way far away from the shore at this point. I don't know.
They're not moving very fast. You know, I mean, it wasn't one-sided. It was, in that scroll, it says it's a battle, right? Like, and they're the only two people that lived in this whole battle. So it's possible that, you know, these people know some guys that didn't come back.
Mm. We don't see Indian bodies at the beginning, but
we don't.
We see Viking bodies. And apparently, one of the criticisms that I read, and I didn't notice them, so I was watching, but they said some of the bodies were like noticeably breathing and still alive. Like it was amateur hour, sort of like that. But I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Like, you know, again, professional actors, this guy's making a movie for $10,000 or whatever it was. And, okay. There is, now, speaking of budget though, there is a helicopter shot in this movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which I have no idea how they got, except, I mean, I guess he hired a helicopter. I don't know. I would love to know the backstory of this movie, like where they got, like how much it costs, where they got the money.
You know, maybe this guy just has some connections, you know, stepdad has a helicopter.
Yeah.
Hey, can you come? Can you fly an hour north on Monday?
He did say he was, they filmed it on his family's land, mostly, in Vermont. Mm. So I get the impression that he does have money. But anyway, some things I didn't remember the rape scene at all. I don't know why. I've seen this twice before this. I have no recollection. I think Tony Stone is also miscast, but you know, he runs into a problem because who else is he going to cast to like take a dump on screen and things like that? Like nobody's going to play this part except him. But he's like, he looks ridiculous. Like he looks like he's 9 years old. And I think it's just because he doesn't have a beard. He should have just grown a little bit of like more scruff out. And would look a little bit more mature. His hair is so like voluminous and huge and blonde. And it looks really silly. I don't like the metal in the movie, but you know.
How did you feel? I think it's chapter two, the chapter two title card camp, where Tony Stone is. Yeah, he's holding the axes out.
That was the
headbanging
big moment. Okay, when this movie came out, I was living with Jonathan, and Jonathan and I were obsessed with seeing this movie. We saw the trailer, we were like, we gotta watch this fucking movie. And when we watched it, that scene happens. That's the reveal, you know? Okay, there's gonna be some weird, anachronistic, weird shit going on. I mean, there's like hints of it earlier than that, like some of the dialogue when he says, we stay here, we're toast, things like that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
This fish is killer, that kind of thing, which I don't understand either. Like, I feel like I don't know why, like, what's the impetus to make the dialogue modern? I don't know what that means, but the metal, when that happened and he's standing there and he's headbanging to metal, it really, I remember both of us just like, okay, this movie just dropped several points for us. Like, what is happening? Why would you do this? We wanted it to be like a Herzog film, you know? We wanted it to be like a sort of brooding, serious, but also could be absurd and spiritual and weird. And you know, it just was, it was weird for all the wrong reasons at that point. We had a big problem with that.
I mean, I
don't hate it as much as I did then. I get the inclusion of metal in it, because like what we've been talking about, its connection with Viking history and mythology and things like that. But I still don't love it. I like the synth stuff, you know, and not turns the synth stuff specifically, just the synth. I like the idea of a synth score with this. I think that works really well.
It looked like he used some like Popol Vuh and he wasn't just using Burzum stuff.
I don't even know which song, you know what I mean? I wouldn't know. It says he used Brian Eno, Judas Priest, Queens of the Stone Age. Like, I don't know which song is which, so.
Well, and I know, like, the Judas Priest song he used is, like, an acoustic song. I think all of the actual, like, metal-sounding metal that we hear, I believe, is Dimmu Borgir. But
is that somebody you're familiar with?
I know the name, but I'm not really familiar with their stuff.
JR is such a metalhead, dude.
I like metal. I like black metal. A lot.
He just made this movie about 10 years too early. He should have used Liturgy as a soundtrack, you know?
Yeah.
Then I would have loved it.
I mean, he could have used this band, but, you know, when they say, we're no longer thralls of the heathen, I was like, fuck yeah, Thou. I've been listening to so much Thou. just put out a new record. It's really good.
Did they?
Yeah.
Oh.
Like 2 weeks ago. Oh. And it's one of their shorter albums, and all the songs are shorter. I was like,
are there vocals on it?
Yeah, dude, sorry. Damn. I know you're never going to get down with Brian's vocals, I know.
I like Brian. I like his performance style. I like him as a person when I've spoken to him a few times. But, yeah, I'm not into the...
Yeah.
But I will listen to this for sure. I didn't realize they released a new album. I love watching them live, man. They're great live. Great live.
They are. I wish they would come back to Denver. It's been a long time since I saw them. But anywho, I was... Heathen is the name of that record, and it's good.
What about... Okay, cause that's not what I'm seeing. I'm seeing Umbilical, which is also 2024.
No, Umbilical is the new one. Heathen is the name of a previous that record.
Oh, I thought you said Heathen is the new
that record. No, when he said, we're no longer thralls of the heathen, I was like, yeah, that's a good one. No, Umbilical is the new one. Umbilical is very... Again, it doesn't have like the 10-minute songs that Dow has done in the past. It's heavy, it's aggressive, it's much faster.
Cool, man. Into it. All right. I like so, I sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead. I was just gonna say more shit.
I was gonna ask you, like I fucked up this whole review by basically starting us on like a a ticky-tack side quest here, but the
it's okay,
it's like the separation is a huge part of this movie, the chapter called Separation, where they go their separate ways, where one guy is seemingly going on the spiritual journey. And I like the IMDb and Letterboxd is like one, like it gets more in touch with this primal nature, and I don't really know if that's the case, but it's certainly what he's doing is certainly different than the guy who's talking to the priest. I know you said you didn't like the plot, but like, how did you feel about Volnord's journey here? Like basically looking at the priest on top of a waterfall and realizing, like, just basically looking and being like, I found Jesus. And then everything
after that. I mean, it's just like what Kevin said earlier. It's a music video, all that stuff. I guess that's the problem, is that like he wants to have a plot. He wants there to be like character development, but he does it through like montage and crossfades. And it's just really bizarre and like not a lot of fun. And there at one point I just skipped ahead like 30 seconds. Like on the thing, like the end of the skip ahead 10, I just did it three times just to see where we're at. And we're in the same shot. Like we're looking at a guy's hands, in the same, and I'm just like, I don't know that we need all this, man. You could have cut this down, made it like a 80-minute movie, and it would have been tighter. And, you'd have gotten all the information you need to get across. And I don't like him. Like if that's what you want to get across, that he's trying to get, that he's getting he's gaining religion through this monk, then you have to connect it somehow to what happened earlier. Why'd you give us the scene of him murdering a Christian and causing his sister's suicide if he's just going to befriend a Christian now and like become a Christian? It's just like, it doesn't make any sense.
To very easily and quickly. And maybe you could say like, he is finally like, he's aware of his mortality in this moment and thinks he's going to die. Just why you do that. But like, one of the reasons this guy would hate Christianity is because he has his own religion with his own gods,
right?
And he would know that he's going to Valhalla, as he mentions earlier. It's like, so that angle doesn't make sense. I couldn't make it make sense.
I agree. And it's like, I was rationalizing as like, okay, he feels bad about having killed the first guy that he killed because it caused his sister's death, so now he's gonna like, take this one more like thoughtfully or something. But it's just, I mean, there's no reason for him to do that, and there's no explanation of that. And I just don't need the priest character. It would have been better if they just murdered both the priests. I really thought they were going to. And but I do love, the only thing that contributes to the film in my opinion is the scene when they reunite and he kills the priest, the other guy kills the priest, and it causes like a fight between them. I did like that. I just liked the way it looked, like how he runs, he rushes up and hits him with the axe and everything. That was some of the best violence for me in the film, which is, it's pretty light on violence, actually. Graphic violence, anyway. especially being that it's unrated and they could have literally done anything they want. I mean, they actually kill animals in this movie, but they don't have, you know, human blood very much in it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that was an example of him understanding his budget limitations. Like, I can't make killing look good.
But I mean, he built, like, he must have spent so long building, like, that teepee hut thing, the sweat lodge or whatever that he was in, and building the Christian monk house thing. And it's just like, you can make blood out of fucking corn syrup and water, man. I mean, I don't know.
And I actually, and it might have looked fine on that camera.
Yeah, but exactly.
When they built their first shelter after the montage of cutting down all the trees, I was like, they didn't use nearly as many trees as they cut down. That's probably because he used the rest for the monk shelter.
That's a good point. That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I do love the scene. There's a shot in particular that I really, really liked toward the end when he's cutting down another tree, like near the very end of the movie. Oh, that's what he's doing. He's building the boat to burn his friend at sea.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and it's going back and forth, and like sun,
the lights coming out. Yeah. I love that, dude, because it was just like it completely blows out the lens that you're just seeing white. I thought that was great, man.
That was good.
And I really love the image of him buried in the snow at the end. Although calling that an epilogue is a little like grandiose for what it is. Like, you just wanted to have some Viking snow action. We get it.
They could have done
more with that. It would have been interesting, but I did like him buried in the snow at the end. Look good.
I did think calling it an epilogue gets me to assume that some time has passed. So clearly it's not going to be like knee deep snow the next day based on where we're at.
Right.
So I accepted it for that reason. But, you know, just the idea that we had chapters at all for this. Like, the chapters were just an excuse for the metal, you know, title cards. And I didn't mind. I probably liked the metal more than you, John, in the title cards. I didn't want him headbanging, but I didn't mind the music itself.
I mean, it's not that I don't like the music, but that's not the reason. I just would have preferred it be. Like, it's a, you know, it's just anachronistic for no reason, but it's just like, I don't know, just bump. It bothers me. I wish it wasn't there. I wish it was like normal or like synth music, or like, it could be anachronistic. It just doesn't have to have like, it's guys singing words. Like, I don't, you know, and it's like, I don't even know what the songs are about, but it's just like, this is not what this movie is taking place in the year 1000. It's like, it's ancient. It should be like something more ancient feeling. Which you can get across with modern instrumentation, but not with fucking distorted guitars and double bass drum, you know? It's fucking ridiculous.
Well, I think it probably would have been better if it was like an actual, like, if he had gotten an actual, you know, already existing metal band to make the score. Like, that probably would have been better instead of just, you know, having like a, you know, Norse metal playlist and like hitting shuffle.
I think having a score at all,
what this seems, I mean, like.
He's definitely using all source music, and I think having just a score would have made it more consistent. That's probably a problem too, just that it's not consistent. It's like
different types
of music, different genres or whatever. But overall, I still like this movie. I still really have respect for it and for Tony Stone as a filmmaker. I wish he would do wilder shit like this, but I mean, now he did that Ted Kaye movie with Charlton Copley about Kaczynski last year.
Yeah,
I
wasn't aware of it until, I didn't realize it was him until this.
Yeah, so. And he also did Peter at the Farm, which is like a documentary that was some people liked, I think, back in the day. But anyway, this movie did drop half a star for me on this rewatch, but it's always been hovering around a 3.5 and a 4. So this rewatch, it's a 3.5, you know? next one it'll probably be a four again. It just depends on how I'm feeling, you know? What do you guys think?
I'm going three. I think it's I did not like the look of it. Like especially like what do they call is it called speed ramping? Where it like it looks like they kind of like artificially have things going faster and like you can like tell.
I didn't notice or, that. During what scene?
I don't know. Maybe you. It was more in the. I'm gonna notice it like more in the beginning and like it's, and like they're showing like scenes with a sister. It seems like it's like sped up a tad.
Maybe.
But yeah. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, for what it is, I think it's interesting enough, and you know, it wasn't a total slogging piece of shit, so.
Good. Nice. I'll take it. JR?
Yeah.
Yeah, my initial, like, instinct, based on just, like, what we see on screen, is to give it a 2.5, because I just think it's, like, two things that don't come together well, and I think part of it is, like, pretty good, and the other part is pretty bad, but then I'm docking another half point for the use of Burzum because it's just unforgivable. It's just hardcore bullshit. I don't know why anyone would do that. We knew in the 2000s, because we've known since the 90s, that Varg is a piece of shit and he's awful, and it's just not acceptable. Just not
fair enough. Two stars. I can't argue with not giving stars to Nazis. That's fair. All right. I don't know how we're going to do. I guess we're going to have to use games today because these people aren't in movies. Unless you want to use Gabby Hoffman.
We could if you want.
No, JR would destroy us with Gabby Hoffman. He's probably seen the Veronica Mars movie.
Of course I have. Exactly. I love Veronica Mars.
Oh my god.
I didn't love the movie, but I love Veronica Mars.
He's probably seen Wild with
I have not. I have not seen Witherspoon.
Just kidding.
I know my wife has read that book.
We're not using Gabby Hoffman. It's not fair. It doesn't really matter. You guys destroyed me in the Vulture trivia game today. Because I kept guessing, what was it? It was ridiculous, dude. I was guessing the wrong thing in the wrong blank, like over and over again. It was Kate Blanchett, Leonardo DiCaprio, and I was like, oh, Kate Blanchett. I was reading Kate Blanchett, and then I was looking at 2005 to 2014. And I kept doing like Kate Blanchett movies from 2005 to 2014, and I was like, I wish I could. This is what really gets you. I was like, I wish I could use The Aviator in this blank, but it's the year before. And I was like, I could have used The Aviator. It was a nightmare, dude.
Yeah.
You did this to yourself.
Yes, I did. So anyway. If you guys want to just call it then, I'll suffer again. I mean,
Did you suffer this time?
No.
Did you suffer this past week?
It's such a weird thing. The homework, the Letterbox Roulette thing, while I love it, and it was my idea, it is like weird because it's like all of a sudden it's like you're already forced to watch a movie for this podcast. Like whatever, if JR was going to be on the next episode, JR would pick the next movie and then we would, you know, whatever it is, we have to watch it. Right. And so that's fine. And then it's just like you have another one on top of that. And the one on top of that is sometimes things that you're not interested in. Not that I wasn't interested in this one. I was. But
yeah,
then you start watching it. And the movie that we watched this time, or that I watched, the Kieslowski film.
I also watched.
Yeah, okay. It's a good film, but it's... I wasn't in the mindset to watch it at all. You know, I was just like, I have to watch this, so I'm going to sit down and watch it. But I was like, it took a lot out of the enjoyment of it that I think I would have normally had I watched
it. Did you log it?
Of my own volition. Yeah, I logged it.
Oh, okay.
I finished it this afternoon.
Oh, I didn't remember seeing it.
But anyway,
yeah, I was supposed, and what happens a lot for me, like, you know, mm-hmm. I was supposed to watch it. Like, I have the DVD, but like, I've, you know, like Sharon and I have started like two movies in the past, like, you know, week and a half, and like haven't finished either of them. Mm. So yeah, it's also weird too, because like this whole thing kind of started life as a quote unquote punishment, you know, because like whoever lost, you know, and like we've talked a lot about like not referring to it as a punishment, or, you know, not, you know, looking at it in those terms, but it seems like we keep going back to it for some reason.
Well, because depending on what the film is, it can be pun. I mean, sometimes, because JR, for some reason, included all these goofy B and C movies from the 60s that are trash, and, you know, sometimes we have to watch those, so.
Yeah.
I don't know, but anyway. It was fun doing Joe Bob's drive-in totals for that I Married a Monster from Outer Space.
Well, okay, so I lost the game today. You guys, you didn't both finish, right? But you came close, both of you, to finishing.
To finishing what?
The game. All nine squares.
Yeah. Well, yep. We shared our results.
I missed the one word title for Orlando Bloom because I couldn't think of Elizabethtown.
And this is the Vulture Cinematrix we're talking about, for people who don't know what we mean.
They do weekends now.
Yeah, I know. They do weekends. It's exciting. So the movie that I will be watching...
And me. You too.
You don't have to watch it. You could. I guess you will. Oh, this is fine. I'll watch this. No problem. Clueless. Amy Heckerling. It's a little bit of a cheat because I have seen this movie half a dozen times in my life, but I will gladly watch it again, as opposed to diving into the randomness of this list and coming out with something even worse. I apparently haven't logged it yet. I mean, I marked it as watch, but I haven't rated it. So this is good. I'll watch Clueless. Let me add that to my watch list. And then we can jump right into our homework from last week, were we all supposed to watch it, or was it me and Kevin and JR just decided to?
I think it was just
you and I, John. And okay. Yeah.
Well,
but yeah,
I like Kieslowski. Yeah. So
right, that's okay. And we watched Kieslowski's The Double Life of Veronique from 1991, starring Irene Jacob, or maybe she says it differently. I don't know. It has an accent mark over the E. An accent aigu. Or is that an accent aigu?
I don't know.
Something like that. I don't know. Anyway. This is a movie about Veronica, who is a singer in Krakow. Well, she lives in Poland. She goes to Krakow. And then
it's like her hobby too.
Right. And then she gets like enlisted to be a professional singer with some chamber music or orchestra or something. It's not like a full orchestra, right? I mean, it's like a little group of, it's like 20 people, right? So I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then she sings and then immediately dies on stage.
Yeah. There are some health issues are alluded to. She seems to be the third generation in this family, where it was like her aunt is like sick but alive, and like her mother and Veronica's mother like both died healthy, as she says. So it's like, she's having some issues. Like when she's singing, we see sums up.
That's what I mean. I never even put any of that together. I was just like, oh, she died. Oh, you know.
So that's funny. My viewing of this movie today was a goddamn like mess. I wanted to watch it last night. Several ways, like 100% put me to sleep. And by that, I mean, I just like finished it 11:30 and could not power through anything else. It was just, I was sleepy because it's been a long week. And so like I watched an hour this morning and then was watching the last 40 minutes in like 5 minute chunks, like trying to get through this, like while my daughter's doing quiet time, but my daughter was a disaster today. It was like, it was, everything's going wrong, but I still love it.
Well, when Veronica sees her double, who is Veronique, the person who looks just like her, on a bus in Krakow, she's a tourist from France.
Yeah.
I immediately understood what this movie was. Like, because I was like, okay, now I get it. Because at first I was like, okay, what does double life of Veronique mean? And at the beginning, Veronica's like, she's like, she's in like a schoolgirl outfit or something. I don't know what she's doing. She's in like a choir, you know, and she's singing in the rain and everything. And then she goes and fucks that guy. And I'm like, okay, is this what they mean by double life? Like she's a nice, charming religious schoolgirl. And then she likes to fuck guys hard, you know, but
we had the two girls at the very beginning, like as young girls, like one's looking at the stars. One looks at a leaf.
These are all things I don't. I mean, but it's like, and
two girls, two languages.
Kevin Jarre says this like he understood this the first time he saw the movie. He's watched the movie a dozen times. I'm sure I did not.
Today, I noticed at the beginning we've got two languages.
I read that those two girls are these two women later on. And when I read that, I was like, what two girls? I don't even remember that happened. Because now I'm like focused. I'm like, oh, I'm focused on Irene Jacobs, you know, her two characters and the performances and what's going on in the plot and stuff like that. And I'm just like, I don't remember the two girls at the beginning. That's something that you would definitely get more out of on a rewatch down the road. But regardless, immediately when I saw the other woman, I was like, okay, this is going to be like a, you know, like an enemy situation or like the double situation, Kevin's movie that he likes with Eisenberg. But obviously less Terry Gilliam inspired. And it's like, then she dies. And I was like, okay, so this is like the classic. This is like the classic idea I had when I was 25, the movie idea where you follow a character for the first half of the film. And then you just immediately start following some other character who has no relation to the first character. I thought this was a brilliant idea back then. But there's more connection here. And that's sort of the point, I think, of the movie is the connection that they seem to share, this weird, like, fate, superstition. I don't even know what you call it, like, supernatural, but it's never explained. It's just like this weird connection that they have to each other and that she has to the world.
And it's only there as like as feelings, like Veronica, Veronique, however you say it, is in France. It's like she feels things and she can't explain what she's feeling. Like after Veronica in Poland dies, like she wakes up, has sex, and then if starts crying because she feels like the sense of grief, whatever she says. And she spends much of her section of the movie like unsure of her feelings, and like she has this sense of loneliness that she can't explain. I think it's strange because like the connections between the two in the movie are like they don't amount to like an important plot thing the way that I think many you would expect them to. It never goes beyond the sort of like feeling and vibes.
Well, yeah, you never figure out what's going on plot wise. Like there's no explanation of like why these two people look exactly the same and are connected in some way mentally. And it's important, I think, to note that Veronique seems to be unaware of Veronica, but Veronica saw Veronique on the bus, but she doesn't see her.
Well, Veronique does see the picture she took of Veronica at the very end.
Oh, that's right.
And
they're fucking and again.
She's confused.
Forgot about that.
She's confused. Yeah, she's like, that's not my coat.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
And then, which leads to her understanding of what the puppeteer is doing with his book. Like, he's writing like a double life book that she is realizing in that moment is like, is this me? But does not say that. That's all I'm getting from Irene Jacobs' face. She has a lot of great acting.
She has a great looking everything. She is a beautiful woman. And I thought her performance was decent. I don't know about, I mean, I wasn't blown away by it, I'll be honest with you, but it was the whole, you know, best actress at Cannes. I don't know what else came out in 91 at Cannes, you know what I mean? But
let's Google Cannes again.
Let's do
it. Every episode.
Let's go. Anyway, but yeah, she's fine in it. And I forget what I was going to say, but anyway, I like the way the movie looks a lot. I thought it was like beautifully shot. And I'm interested to see more Kieslowski stuff. I didn't dislike this movie. I don't want to put that out there. I like the movie. I just wasn't. A lot of people I follow are blown away by this movie, and I was not blown away by it. But again, I wasn't planning to watch this movie, you know? If this is on my watch list and it came up and I'm like, yeah, if tonight feels like a Double Life of Veronique night, then I would have probably appreciated it more. But instead I'm like, I really got to finish this movie before the podcast. Let me put it on.
But John, that's the thing with the homework is like, we have movies like this on our watch lists, but we're never, ever like, tonight's the night.
I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true, though. It becomes tonight's the night. This movie wouldn't have been the first Kieslowski movie I watched if I had been left to my own devices. I would have watched a short film about killing, or I would have watched a Decalogue or something, and then I would have been like, okay, now I understand Kieslowski, or I like Kieslowski, or like I'm interested to see more, and then I would watch something like this. This would never have been the first movie I watched by him. Hmm. How do you find 91, for God's sake?
Roman Polanski was the president of the jury.
Perfect.
In competition, we had Barton Fink.
Hey.
A Jacques Rivette film, La Belle Noiseuse. Looking for Europa, Lars von Trier. Jungle Fever, Spike Lee.
Dude, Annabella Shore from Jungle Fever. There you go. Done. She's better.
The Pilote Van Gogh movie, which is okay. Yeah, I Boys in the Hood was
I've never seen Boys in the Hood.
Uncertain Guard competition.
In 91?
Yeah.
I thought Boys in the Hood was like 93 or 94. I don't know. I mean, obviously it's not. You're telling me, but I don't know. I really thought it was.
Cohen got Best Director for Barton Fink.
Did it win the Palme d'Or?
He got Best Actor as well. Palme d'Or, yeah, skipped over that one. Sorry. wow, Palme d'Or director and actor. It is rare.
That is hardcore.
They usually spread the awards around. Samuel L. Jackson won Best Supporting Actor for Jungle Fever. That's cool.
Oh, Europa. Homicide? This is a good year. Jungle Fever. Fuck yeah. Bill Duke, A Rage in Harlem. Never seen that one, actually. Yeah. Well, you know, maybe she was the best that year. I don't know. She's good. I don't have any problem with her performance. It's just, I just wasn't blown away overall. So, but I do love the way the movie looks. I love the sort of green tinting that he does on certain scenes. Really cool looking.
Yeah, the green was surprising. I had forgotten the green. It's like I think of this movie as very red. I think that has to do with his movie Red that came out in the 80s as well. But I think it was the 80s. Maybe it was 90. But
those were after this.
Red was after this?
I believe. I thought that I read that on his Wikipedia page, that he made those three films with the success of this. He was able to make those.
Cool. Okay. But yeah, the green was surprising, and it was cool to see the green interact. There's a lot of like red and yellow that green is interacting with, and it looks very cool. Very good.
I did like the marionette scene too. I thought that was cool. I wish they did like a marionette show like this that you could go see. Like, I'd like to go see that. That's cool. Kids see marionettes, you know?
It was cool. Like, you could see his hands.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't hiding his hands.
But that was interesting too. Is like, because you really, you forget that his hands are there. You see them, but you're like, you're paying attention to the movement of the, and it's like a person moving. Yeah. It was really interesting.
That's cool. It was cool.
That was really cool. John Mahoney is in Barton Fink. I haven't seen Barton Fink in like 20 years, man.
Yeah, he's like Barton Fink's like hero, and like when there's that one scene where he's like he goes into the bathroom and he hears somebody just losing their lunch like nobody's business. And then it's John Mahoney. He's like, You're such and such, you're the greatest writer of our generation. Now, if you'll excuse me, son, I've got drinking to do.
he's in an episode of Frasier, right?
Yeah, a couple. all right. Well, let's continue. What are we talking about this week? Who wants to begin with what we watched?
JR, you want to talk about Godzilla Minus One?
Sure.
Yeah.
Finally wrapped up 2023. Finally.
Yeah.
It's June.
Hey, I published my list a while ago, like last month.
Oh my God. Last month.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Godzilla Minus One because it takes place before the original Godzilla film, which, as a concept, I thought sounded weird, but you know, I think it's fine.
Well, I thought it was, my brother told me it was Minus One because, like, after, you know, two atom bombs and losing World War II, like, they were at zero. So then Godzilla shows up and now they're -1.
There's that too, but but you know, I don't know. I thought that also like clearly worked as like an interesting way to make its status as a prequel clear. But anyway, you know, this is a Godzilla movie that is probably ultimately still like more in line with American Godzilla movies, because there's like a shit ton of plot and, you know, character development that is often clunky and extraneous, and it doesn't all work, but I thought it was certainly much better than any American Godzilla movie, and better also than any of the Godzilla movies that came after the first
one. Better than Zemeckis' masterpiece? Not Zemeckis. Zemeckis. Roland Emmerich's masterpiece? Sorry.
Sucks.
Are you guys interested in a Zemeckis directed Godzilla film? Sorry. Just kidding.
Yes.
Okay.
Do it. Maybe. I don't know.
I botched that one. My bad.
Since they're going to keep making these goddamn Godzilla and Kong movies,
Why not
the Zemeckis one?
But Minus One is not related to the, or is it, to the ongoing Universal stuff?
It's different. Right. Yeah, this is.
It is, but it is. It's Toho, right? Like.
Yeah, it's Toho. Yeah.
Toho had some sort of deal where it was like, with the 2014 one with
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that Toho Ryan had like Cranston some sort of deal. And yeah. Juliette Binoche for some reason. They were like, the deal was like, you can't make a Godzilla movie for some amount of years. And I think that time ran out, and that's when they made Godzilla Minus One. This movie won a goddamn Oscar for visual effects.
Best visual effects.
Which,
and I can see why. I mean,
I don't know.
Oh, JR doesn't see why.
Well, when I, you know, it's like, I know this was a small budget, and I think it's pretty incredible what they did on a small budget. But like, I don't know. That Mission Impossible movie also came out, and its effects were really fucking cool. I think that Godzilla moving through water was, you know, not always the best. But I think a lot of like the small things that they did were really cool. But yeah, Kevin, did you like this Godzilla movie?
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, like looking at it, it does kind of play like a by the numbers kind of disaster movie. You know, there's lots of, you know, like there are certain parts that people are playing and like certain emotional beats and, you know, like, oh, we got him. Oh, no, we didn't get him. You know, that kind of stuff. But I mean, I thought it worked, and I thought, you know, I didn't think anything was overly stupid or ridiculous. And, you know, like, and it looks fucking great. Like, you know,
it does as being a prick. It does look really good. Holding those good.
Visual effects aside, like, you know, all the shots of them, you know, when they're out like on the islands and, you know, out on the ocean, like those all look great. And this
way more like just water, like sea seafaring than I expected. Like, I didn't know that we'd be out on the water as much as we were.
Yeah,
and a lot of that. You know, we'll call it like a chase. There's a boat chase, or Godzilla chases a boat. That makes no sense given the speed at which we see Godzilla moving. It's like he would have caught that boat instantly, but it looks really good and it's exciting.
Yeah. And it was interesting too, like the way they were, you know, using, like, I think in the, like, the original one, you know, the original Gojira, I think they just, you know, detonate like another nuke or like something that like depletes all the oxygen around Godzilla or something. The way they, you know, use their like chemical and engineering know-how to get around the stuff instead of using like a science Mary Sue device. I thought that was really cool.
I really liked the scene where like the scientist is like giving a presentation in front of like 200 people just like, and then everyone like starts yelling at it as if like anyone would know what the fuck he's talking about.
Yeah
And then the pilot's like, but will this kill him? It's like that guy got really intense after his girlfriend died, man. I don't know. It's like the Atom Age, like the way that the war ended for Japan has always been like this subtext for Godzilla, and this movie made it very much text. And I don't know if like a Godzilla movie like had to do that, but you know, I guess it's effective emotionally to see all these people, you know, dealing with the aftermath of war in a rough way.
Yeah.
All right. Godzilla minus one.
All right.
Did you watch black and white or color?
Color.
Okay. Same.
Yeah.
Fuck it. Wait.
All right. I didn't know Kaylee Spaney was in the new Alien movie. Romulus. Anyway.
Yeah.
Which they released a new trailer for Romulus. I don't know if you guys saw it.
Did not.
I haven't.
Looks good. I am in.
This is Fede. Fede, right?
Yeah, man. Feed. Feed Alvarez. Yeah, that guy's hit and miss, but I'm hoping this is a big hit for him. So
yeah.
I watched Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, in the movie theater in Limax, big Limax. And this is directed by George Miller, of course. This is the sequel to the the much ballyhooed Oscar winning action picture Mad Max Fury Road from 2015. And it's been 9 long years, and he finally returns with a sequel. It's a prequel, actually, about the origins of Charlize Theron's character in that movie, who here is played as an adult by Anya Taylor-Joy. Although, you know, Anya Taylor-Joy doesn't show up till about the hour mark, I'd say.
Yeah, I would have guessed right? a third into it, and that's a little longer than a third, I would.
Yeah, so Alia Brown plays young Furiosa, and she's decent. And I will say that this movie did not blow my socks off. But then, you know, Fury Road didn't either. When I first saw it, I only recently came around to like it as much as I do now. And but this one, I don't know that this one's going to have the same grower over shower sort of story with me, because I sort of understand immediately what I don't like about this, and I'm not sure it's going to change. And it's mainly the structure of it, which, you know, Fury Road is great because it's a chase film. It's just a long action set piece that never stops. I mean, it stops briefly here and there, but not really. There's always tension. There's always like the fear that the bad guys are getting closer and closer. And there's always these massive action situations that happen because of that. And it's just a lot of fun. It's a blast. And it's an hour and 40 minutes. This movie is 2.5 hours. And it's not a long action set piece. It's got scenes with characters talking to each other.
It takes place over the course of decades. Or maybe a decade.
Yeah, maybe like a decade. So at the beginning of the film, we've got Furiosa, who you see it in the plot synopsis on Letterboxd, she's snatched from the green place of many mothers and falls into the hands of the great biker horde led by the warlord Dementis. And that whole scene is amazing. Her getting snatched and her mother, who is just an absolute badass, trying to get her back. And it's great. That's just good stuff, because you get to see Furiosa isn't just the way she is because of how she was raised by Dementis or Immortan Joe or whatever, or in the wasteland. She's a badass because her mother, who is from this peaceful place, is a badass, you know? So it's that, I like that a lot. And the first problem arises when she, you know, gets to Dementis, who's played by Chris Hemsworth, who is giving just this really broad, goofy performance with this silly prosthetic on his nose and fake beard that looks like a fake beard. And because he's playing it so broad and comedic, it's like not threatening at all, even though he's doing horrible things throughout the entire movie. He's an evil guy. But he's also like trying to be funny constantly, and that just doesn't work for me at all. I hated that. And about midway through the movie, you've got this really epic action set piece that just really feels incredible. Feels like it could have been in Fury Road. Really amazing stuff. It lasts for about 20 minutes, and then it ends, and you realize, oh no, that was it. That we're done now. There's no, we can't get back to that peak, and they don't even try to get back to the peak. It's like they realize it. This is it. We're gonna blow our load in the middle of the movie, before she's even Furiosa. Like, this is right when she becomes an adult. It's just like we have this massive, and it's informing her character. It makes sense narratively, and it's where she's introduced to another character who's very, very important to her journey, but. That scene is so good that to have, even if you had a lesser scene at the end that was still action, I would have been okay with it. But instead they decide, well, there's no way we can top it, so we just won't even have any more action. We'll just have,
I mean,
like, you know.
You don't think the bullet town thing counts as action?
The bullet town, there, the just bullet the two town of them? Thing counts as action? No, that's action. Is that as good as the chase scene?
No, it's not. Okay. No, but I don't think it's bad. And Let me ask you this.
Is the confrontation that happens at the end of the movie, is that as good as any? I mean, having no action at the end of the movie, does that make any sense?
Certainly not if you don't like Dementis. Dementis has to have worked for you.
There should be a fight at the end. Like, at least, I mean, there should be, you got, it's just like, it's, the dialogue isn't strong enough. The ideas aren't strong enough for it to just be Furiosa and Dementis talking and, you know, having it out. Like, the best line in the movie, the best line in the movie is when he says, you have it in you to make it epic. And when he says that, I was like, this doesn't sound like anything Dementis has said in this entire movie.
Yeah, except that Dementis has been obsessed with his, I guess, you're right.
Yes.
I'm not going to fight you. I like Dementis more than you, and I understood the connection that Miller made there with, like, his idea of narrative, like, tying, you know, he very clearly is obsessed with, like, power, and I think, you know, him tying that into the idea of epic makes sense to me. It also just kind of like goes with Miller's seeming fascination with just like these like classic story tropes and like almost in like biblical stuff that was also very apparent in like the 3,000 years of longing. Like this all felt like tied together for me, even if it didn't work on its own.
I don't have a problem with his themes or his illusions. I like all that stuff, and I obviously 3,000 years long he rocked, you know. But is it 3 or 5? Is 3,000?
I think it was 3,000.
Yeah, it's
3,000.
Okay. Anyway, so I'm just quickly looking it up. Yeah, 3,000. Okay. But this is also co-written by someone, Nico Lathouris. I guess he also co-wrote Fury Road. Never mind. I take it all back. But anyways, I don't know. Something about the dialogue just didn't. I mean, I don't think the dialogue in Fury Road is all that strong, to be honest. I think it's works because there's so little of it, you know, because you don't care about what the characters say to each other. You care about how they behave with one. It's just like the scene in Fury Road where Mad Max is trying to use the scoped rifle and he's missing. And Furiosa comes up to him behind him and it's just like, without dialogue, you totally understand the dynamic here. He can't do this. He's not as skilled of a shooter as she is. He realizes that after he misses a few times and he gives the rifle to her and then she uses his shoulder and she makes the shot, right? So it's just like, you don't need dialogue. Like even in the original Mad Max films, you don't have that much dialogue. In Red Road Warrior, you have very little dialogue. Max doesn't need to talk that much. Furiosa doesn't need to talk that much. You know,
we get it. And Furiosa doesn't talk that much in this either. And I don't think the movie has a ton of dialogue. It's just that when Chris Hemsworth is on screen,
he's talking a lot.
He's talking.
Yeah.
He's always.
You agree that his performance is broader, right?
Yeah, and I don't think it was bad.
Yeah, I don't think it was. I don't know if it's bad. It's just not. It doesn't fit for me. Even though you could just as easily say Immortan Joe, like the guy who plays that, is being broad. Like Hugh Keith Byrne is broad in Fury Road, and it's a big performance. But that somehow fits. Like this doesn't feel right to me. I don't know, something, and maybe it's just because I recognize him. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's the Marvel guy. That's Chris Hemsworth, you know?
And isn't it? It's like everyone else, like besides Anya Taylor-Joy and like there's Tom Burke there as an important character, but
nobody
like,
knows Tom Burke.
Yeah, I guess I know Tom
Burke. I know Tom Burke.
Who? Yeah. What do you know
John
him from?
John Cheever, Ted, you and John Cheever?
Oh, is he in that? Jesus Christ, is that him?
That's him, yeah.
Holy God.
Yeah,
I didn't even know that. I knew him. I recognized him immediately, and then I looked it up afterwards, and I was like, "Oh yeah, he's Orson Welles in Mank, and he's also he's the pedophile brother of Ryan Gosling in Only God Forgives."
Yep,
I do not remember that.
Wants to fuck a 14-year-old. He says at the beginning of the movie.
Well, my point was that like everyone else is like an Australian actor. Mm-hmm. That you're not gonna recognize, you know, minus like a couple, like three of the people that work with Immortan Joe, who were in Fury Road, who were also just like random Australian dudes, and like the guy who played Immortan Joe in Fury Road died. He did not recast him as someone that we would recognize. It's just like some guy that kind of fit that body type. And like, you know, having the Furious's mother at the beginning was a chance for him to cast someone big to come in and have a small role. But instead he cast a woman that you would only recognize if you've seen Anyone But You.
Good
Glenn Powell, Sydney Sweeney movie.
And I also read that this woman who plays her mother, Charlie Fraser, is like she's like a big deal in the modeling world. Like she was the most, she was like the most requested model during New York Fashion Week this last year or something. Wow. So like she's huge in that. So I think this is like her breaking into movies.
She's,
you know?
She's stunning, and she gets some of like the best material in in Anyone But You.
Oh,
which again is bad.
Furiosa.
No, but like she's a very memorable role here, and it's good. So maybe she's good. That'd be cool.
I mean, I'm into it. I just really all that stuff at the beginning with her chasing down the guys and all that stuff rocked.
So quiet, like that also was like. I liked sort of the auditory stuff in this movie. Like we are listening for motorcycles. Like this, we had this vast empty wasteland. So it's like, I need to hear how far away they are. And also, oh shit, I recognize that engine. Like I can tell which motorcycle that is.
And it goes on a really long time too. I was really excited about it at the beginning. I was like, this is a scene. This whole sequence of her getting taken and her mother trying to get her back should, you know, in a normal action film, this would take, you know, 10 minutes, but it feels like it just took like, half an hour at the beginning of the film, you know, there, which is, but it was great the whole time. I was having a blast with it at that point. So, but anyway, I it's something I'm looking forward to watching again. And, I did read the prequel comic book before watching this, which I thought was a lot of fun.
And, I haven't read that.
It's decent. They get a bunch of different artists to do different stories, like how Immortan Joe came into power and how Furiosa got to where she is. And it's different than this. It's not the story. It's like what happens between the end of this and the beginning of Fury Road, if that makes sense. But anyway, yeah. All right. Kevin?
I don't really have anything else to talk about. I mean, I watched one of the SpongeBob movies. I watched Emperor's New Groove, and I enjoyed both of those. And I watched Neon Genesis Evangelion, the anime, and that was really good and enjoyable. Except for a couple of episodes where it's like, oh, wow, this got real dark real fast. But, you know, so I'm kind of out.
All right. JR?
Yeah, I mean, I've been crushing the tape, especially in relative to my past few months. I watched a lot, and I won't talk about all of it. I want to mention The Man from Del Rio, which is an Anthony Quinn Western from 1956. And I want to mention it because I thought it was a really good Western that had some unique elements that you guys should watch. I'm recommending it.
I watched
That was like a Kino Lorber Blu-ray that my library got. So I was like, let's check it out. And, you know, I've mostly been watching 2024 stuff, and some of that stuff has been really good. And I guess I feel like talking about Hitman because it's a Richard Linklater movie. And I know at least John watched it. Kevin, did you watch Hitman?
I have not.
Okay. I'll go Hitman. Richard Linklater's new film on Netflix starring Glenn Campbell, who I just mentioned.
And, Glenn Campbell.
Like, sorry, Glenn Powell.
There's country music in this.
I know, right?
All right, you're good.
And Adria Arjona, Arjona, I don't know how to say her last name, who I know mostly from shows like Good Omens and Irma Vep. I know she's in some other stuff too. And this is like a few different movies. I guess it's a rom-com, but it keeps kind of like switching up what kind of movie it is. And it is trying very hard to get like a balance of tone that I think probably doesn't work for everyone. I'm guessing it didn't work for John since I saw his rating and he said he was struggling to get through it. But Glenn Powell, not Campbell, is a philosophy teacher at UNO, University of New Orleans, represent, with the empty ass, just blank classroom that just has a UNO decal in the back. that is not what my classrooms looked like when I went there. And he is adrift. He is lame. He, for some reason, moonlights as like a type of consultant for the cops, but I guess not consultant really. He's like setting up. He's doing like the tech angle, setting up stings.
He's John Travolta in Blowout. He's the guy who can do the audio right for their for their stings.
Except like John Travolta is like a sound film guy like that.
You know what, though, JR, you love this movie, and Glenn Powell, you know, they explain all that away with like half a line during the opening montage, right? I really love electronics, and I masterminded this whole thing. So,
I don't.
There you go. Done.
I don't love this movie. Fixed. But anyway, through another like just insane contrivance, this dorky Glenn Powell character, who no one really likes, is put in a position where like he has to be the operator of the sting. This is entrapment. These are entrapment operations. I don't know how they're legal, but since this is in Louisiana and since the real story of this was in Texas, I guess, you know, laws don't matter. You know, Louisiana is a state where we, until very recently, set up stings to convict, you know, gay men for sodomy. Just insane. But, you know, anyway, this guy who usually plays the hitman to these people who are looking for a hitman, who's going to like collect money and get these people on tape to say, like, I want you to kill this person or whatever. Glenn Powell is thrown into that position where he's going to be doing that. And he's immediately good at it, throws himself into the role, starts doing like research and making disguises for these people. It's insane. It is like technically very stupid, but it makes for some nice visual gags. And then he does an operation where he meets Adria Arjona's character, and he seems to like her because her story is sad and she's also beautiful. And then it becomes kind of a romantic comedy where he is going to like hide his identity while talking to her because he's like playing a hitman.
Yeah, he's a scumbag in this movie, but which is one of the many things that is just so like not working for me in this movie. It's just like, okay, I get it.
It's so weird.
I get it. It's a comedy, you know.
There is a fucking dog down here just ruining my goddamn life. Just farting so much. Where are you? All right, sorry. It's okay. It smells awful in here.
You gotta feed your dog Purina One Chow. Anyway, Glenn Powell's character here, Gary Johnson. I know it's a comedy, but like, are you buying for a second that he's like a nerd who can become a sexy, you know, like if you're a nerd, you don't care about your abs, but this guy has abs. So like,
we don't see him with a shirt off. Do we?
We so do. He has sex with what's her face like 15 times in this movie.
Oh, there's only one scene where shirts come off though. But okay. You're right.
Okay. I know I'm right. Glenn, you know what else I know? Regardless of whether you see his abs or not, he's got abs. This is Glenn Powell. I know he's got abs. I watched Top Gun Maverick. Okay.
Yeah, he's got abs. He's an ab man. You're right.
He's ripped up. And I just don't like if he like when he says like, okay, I put on this act as Ron, you know, I'm Ron now, the hitman. But then he's able to be Ron with her nonstop. Then why doesn't he just be Ron? You know, like I don't understand if that's what he wants to be, because obviously that's the guy who gets the woman. And then it's like this throwaway line at the end. Oh, I found a good balance between Gary and Ron. That's why I'm able to be married to this woman. It's just so ridiculous and stupid. Like you said, you just said it was stupid. This is a dumb movie.
The costume stuff is stupid. I don't know. Maybe it's stupid. There's a balance of charm and stupid and clever, and
I yeah, that's where being
scumbags and Linklater, like, successfully for me and for many others, like pulling a fast one, but like getting you to like these characters who are objectively awful.
Oh, see, that okay, I like. Yeah, that did not work because I was like, this guy is not a good guy. Not that I was like, I can like
none of them are good guys.
Sure, I can like a character who's not a good guy. That's not a big deal. For me, you know what it really was? I was watching this movie, and I watched it in two parts. And the first hour of this movie, literally nothing happens. Like, it's Gary Johnson going and putting people away. Like, it's these goofy montages of him in costumes that are supposed to be funny but are not funny, and I'm sorry, there's nothing clever going on there. And I mean, coming from Linklater, who can write very, very well, like he's an interesting writer, I like his films, there's nothing interesting going on when he's, you know, Glenn Powell is dressed up as a fucking whatever his name is.
Bateman.
Patrick Bateman. Yeah, right. And or the German guy with the yellow suit. I don't even know what's going on there. And it's like, I get it. I get why people might find that funny. Like people like my mom might find that funny. That's not interesting to me. And then he's like, finally, after he meets her, even nothing happens. He meets her, whatever. He goes off script. He lets her go, you know. Oh, and then they go on a date, which is interminable. I'm just like, this date is so long, and they're talking about nothing, and I don't care. Get to something. And it's like with a Linklater movie. With a Linklater movie, you would expect it to be plotless, and you would have fun. But it's a movie about a guy who pretends to be a hitman for a living. There should be a plot. Finally, the plot kicks in outside the bar in the alley. The husband confronts him. Decent scene. I don't mind that. I like that he pulls the gun on him. He doesn't hold the gun right, but it makes sense because he doesn't know what a gun does, right? He's not really a hitman. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Unfortunately, okay. They do show us him shooting a gun earlier in the film.
That's true. But he probably has never pointed one at a human being before, right? Fair?
Yeah, I would think so.
Okay. So anyways. At that point when the plot kicks in, I was like, okay, now it's starting to get interesting. At least I'm not like, you know, bored by this. I'm going to put my phone away. I'm going to start watching this movie now. but it's not the worst thing I've ever seen. It's not like a piece of shit movie or anything. I just had so many issues with it. And I was like, before that happened, I was like, this movie is like a 2, dude. I was surprised at how much I was not enjoying it. And then, the plot kicks in, and then the plot is problematic too, because of course, like we said, there, these people aren't doing good things. It's weird because by the end of the movie, there is a murder. I don't want to give anything away. There is a murder, and you're just like, well, you're sort of undercutting this entire. I mean, like you said, I guess he's trying to get us to root for these people doing bad things, but I'm not rooting for him. I'm just like, this seems like a really hardcore thing to be doing, and they don't give a fuck. They're just like, let's do this. Sounds good. You know, like, and I'm just like, this seems really fucking dark and weird all of a sudden. It's got some cool imagery. The way they killed the guy is cool. I don't mind that. And I don't mind that character specifically dying. He was a weirdo. But I don't know. Overall, just didn't work on a lot of levels. I probably should have gone 2.5. I probably gave it a little Linklater bump. You know, I like the guy. Okay? But
this guy. This is not my kind of guy.
No, Linklater is my kind of guy. Powell, I'm still out. I'm still the jury's out on Powell, but I like I like Linklater.
Austin Emilio is the other actor. So I just couldn't think of his name, and I liked him. He was.
Who's that? Oh, Jasper.
The other cop, Jasper.
Right. Yeah, he's good. I like him.
I liked him, and he's also a an Everybody Wants Some guy.
Yeah, I like Everybody Wants Some. way more than this, anyway.
Well, it's better than this.
Yeah, it is. That's what Linklater ought to be doing. Hangout movies, man. That's what he does. Hangout. This movie reminded me so much of Bernie, and I didn't like Bernie either. And they're just like these plot-heavy movies based on fucking newspaper articles. And I don't know why he makes movies like this. Or like even like Bad News Bears or School of Rock, which are, and I'll grant you, I have never seen those movies, but I guarantee you they're in this same vein.
I don't know, man. That, like, I haven't seen Bad News Bears. School of Rock is in a different vein with me, with like Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Which, like,
yeah,
it's like a real like Hollywood movie. Right. Hitman. And Hitman sort of like, and Bernie, I feel like they're half there. They've got the famous actors in them, but they're still like very like low key. Whereas, I don't know.
You know, and I totally forgot he did Apollo 10.5. That was decent. I enjoyed that.
I never got around to it.
I remember liking it. It was solid. I actually tried to get my dad to watch it, but you know, because it's like full of. Like, it's set in Houston in the 60s, and it's just, like, full of all these, like, a normie would call them Easter eggs, I guess, but they're just, like, references to stuff from my dad's childhood that he would be interested in. But, anyway, just, you know, whatever. Linklater's old. He's done. He's not going to make another Slacker or Waking Life or Before Trilogy. He doesn't have it in him. It's over.
I mean, he's currently doing some like multi-year thing with Paul Mescal.
That's cool. I mean, I'll watch whatever he does.
He was filming something in Paris recently. It's not on Letterboxd that I see. He's doing, Merrily We Roll Along. I think that's the Paul Mescal thing.
Speaking of Paul Mescal, I'm just ready for that Gladiator 2 trailer. Am I right? I keep seeing images. I'm just like, dude, like, let's go. Give me that trailer. I know it's cut already. They showed it at the CinemaCon. I'm excited. Anyway. Okay. Well, I don't know how to continue because we both talked about that movie, but I guess I'll go since that was technically your turn. I watched Civil War, directed by Alex Garland, which is one of the other big sort of 2024 releases that's come out this year. It was okay, not great. You know, this is a movie that just refuses to take a stand and be about how bad Trump is. No, I'm just kidding. That's a lot of the criticism you hear is, right? It's like not liberal enough. There's no politics in this movie really at all. It's, I mean, you can get the impression that like, what's his face? Nick Offerman is playing a Trump facsimile, but there's no evidence of that at all. Really. He's the president. He's just like a generic president who makes a very generic speech at the beginning that doesn't tell you anything about anything. And that's the point. I think Garland doesn't want to make a movie about what would actually happen if the country went to civil war. I think he wants to make a movie about, to borrow a phrase from Miss Goldberg, man's inhumanity to man, about how people, how people treat each other, in extreme situations, And I think it's interesting that they chose to use journalists as like the main characters, so that they're also like removed from the from being on one side or the other. In fact, they're often embedded with one side, and then like in the next scene they'll be with the opposing side taking pictures. And some of the action battle scenes and stuff are really well done, actually. But I guess you're, you know, watching this movie just because it's called Civil War and you've got a poster that it's just, this poster is so good. This movie does not live up to the promise of this poster with the sniper nest in the torch of the Statue of Liberty. So cool. You never get anything like that. But I get, you know, the whole time I'm watching the movie and I just kept thinking of like, okay, like these, we're at war with each other, right? So I mean, like logistically, there are no other countries involved. Like, wouldn't every country on Earth be involved if America went to war with itself? Like, you know what I mean? There's no way they're going to sit by and let us destroy the biggest economy in the planet, the, you know, the strongest nations. Like, this is not going to happen. I don't know. Something would, they would take one side or the other. I mean, the same thing happened in the original Civil War, right? The French wanted to support one side. I forget which one it was. And, they were going to send weapons to them or something. I don't know. Anyway, this movie is not about that. It's just about, again, it's about how people can be cruel to one another and vicious and evil and just based on circumstances of what's happening in the world. And Kirsten Dunst is fine in it. Wagner Moura is fine in it. Kelly Spaney is better in this than she was in Priscilla. And everybody's talking about this scene with Jesse Plemons. Like, temper your expectations, guys, okay? It's no big deal, okay?
People just really like him.
Right, I know. Now. I realize that, and I'm excited about Kinds of Kindness, but, like, he's in the movie for, like, 4 minutes, and it's not mind-blowing, okay? Even the scene, what happens in the scene, stuff like it has already happened in the movie a dozen times. I don't know what we're impressed about by that scene. I really don't. But anyway, the way that scene resolves itself is more exciting than the scene itself. Yeah, that's Civil War. A middling Alex Garland movie. Better than Ex Machina. Actually, you know what? As far as directing, this might be his best movie. No, well, Devs. Devs is better. I like Men better, too, honestly, but I know a lot of people hate Men. I feel ashamed to say I like Men. Ooh, but Men is good. Men is not
bad. I really liked Men.
Yeah, Men is good, man. A lot of people just like, trash. I don't know. See, there you go. I don't know.
It's pointless.
Oh, give me a break. You might watch Civil War and feel the same way. I watch Annihilation and feel like it's pointless, so.
Yeah, I mean, Men had at least some, I mean, Rory Kinnear puts in, you know, several great performances, but Annihilation was just pure shit.
I thought Jesse Buckley was great in Men as well. And I love Devs. I think Devs is his best work. Well, he's written some amazing shit too, though. 28 Days Later rocks. Dread rocks, Sunshine rocks. This guy's he's the best. Anyway.
We've come back around.
I know, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, JR, you got anything else?
Yeah, I want to do just like a couple other mentions. I know we're going long here, but two movies I thought were very much worth your time. One was Gasoline Rainbow, the new one from Turner and Bill Ross, about a group of brand new high school graduates who travel from their tiny town. I think it's in Arizona where they are, maybe Nevada.
Small town Oregon, it says.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah, and decide that they want to see the ocean. So going less far than I thought because they just go to Portland. But it's still far for them. They're doing this with like one van, no money. Just trying to like make it while they're out there. And
is this documentary?
It is not.
Oh, because don't these guys do documentaries usually? Like, isn't Chapatulas and Bloody Nose and Empty Pockets, aren't those documentaries? Am I wrong about that?
Bloody Nose and Empty Pockets is not really a documentary.
No?
It's like they added narrative to, like, the last night of this bar.
Mm.
But the bar is real. That's like a hybrid. This is not a hybrid. This is full fictional. Like, it's very clearly a written story, even though it is using non-actors for the most part. And it's just, it's cool. This the strip is cool. And you will likely feel like you have met these teenagers before in your life. And, you know, you might not like them.
But where did you watch this?
This is on Mubi.
Okay, I thought so, but it doesn't say it's on Mubi. It says it's not streaming on its Letterboxd page.
It's definitely on Mubi.
Okay, I will check this out.
And the other one is The Promised Land, directed by Nikolai Arcel, which is just added to Hulu recently, a Mads Mikkelsen movie, where it's like the 1700s. He is a impoverished, you know, vet of the Dutch army, or I think he was shipped off to the German army, but he is Danish. But he, like, decides he wants to make it his job or goal to create a settlement and farm in the Danish Jutland, the Heath, which a text at the beginning tells us is, like, famously impossible to cultivate. So it's a man against the elements movie. And it is very dark, is very pretty. Mads Mikkelsen is very good. And it's like it has a very traditional sort of like a historical, you know, guy story. But I think they do some really cool things with it. It's one of my favorites of the year for sure so far.
I like that the original title is Bastarden.
Yeah. His bastard lineage is important.
Sweet.
I guess they thought they couldn't market that very well in America.
All right. What's your number?
For 2024?
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Let's check, because I also watched bullshit like The Idea of You. Don't watch that.
I know you watched a lot of 2024 stuff since the last episode. So
I watched The First Omen. That was pretty cool. I watched How to Have Sex on Mubi. Liked that a lot.
Come on, give me the number.
24.
Fuck you.
24 for 24.
Fuck your face. You're one above me. All right, I'm going to watch The Promised Land tonight, I guess.
I gotta line something up here.
I'm not going to watch this movie tonight. It's 2 hours long, dude. I'll watch something, though. Do something. We'll get it done.
It's good, man.
I have downtime at summer school. I can watch some stuff. So, okay, well, I'm not going to talk about anything else. I don't guess. I rewatched Macbeth, the Orson Welles Macbeth, and it worked for me more than it has in the past. I, in particular, the scene where they kill Banquo and they're hiding in the branch of the tree. I don't know if you guys remember this.
No.
The murderers are in the branch of a tree and Banquo is riding underneath them. And Banquo says to his son, it looks like rain, you know, which is, I mean, that's the line. It looks like rain. And then the first murderer says, let it come down. Mm-hmm. And he says, let it come down as he jumps down on top of him and stabs him, which is, I thought that was really wonderful. In Cohen's version, he's talking to the murderer and, like, making small talk. It looks like rain tonight, you know, and then the murderer's like, let it come down. And the other guy attacks him. Still good. Still really good. I like this better a little bit, but that scene anyway, not overall. Overall, that's still the better film. But anyway, yeah. Just really, I'm on an infinite Shakespeare kick. I can't get enough Shakespeare. I'm teaching Romeo and Juliet to my freshman summer school kids. And when I say and when I say teaching, I just mean I'm reading it for fun in front of them because they don't care. But I've been showing them scenes from the DiCaprio film and the Baz Luhrmann film, which they didn't get to watch. It's so good. It is so good, dude. Literally every second of it is amazing. I'm gonna have to rewatch that soon in its entirety and give it a 7 out of 5. All right. Well, next time on the show, JR is not planning on being here, so we're gonna try to have a very special guest. But no promises. We'll have somebody who will join us and discuss a film of their choosing. And until then, you know, visit our website, filmyak.castos.com. You can write to us, filmyakpodcast@gmail.com. And like and subscribe. Subscribe? I don't even know. Go to wherever you listen to podcasts and, you know, follow us. We have a Facebook page. We have an Instagram page. Check it out. At Film Yak Podcast. And we'll see you later. Bye-bye. And it's all